And for planning purposes, we're hoping by 3:45 or 4, we can revisit the gaming bills that were left on the agenda from yesterday. If we can get them done in a fairly short order, we can avoid a meeting later tonight. And so that's the plan. But first we want to start with some energy discussion, as that'll be our next subject that we'll be moving into. And as a committee that oversees energy and some of the changes in the energy and world, one of the things that became interesting to me, and some have talked about it, but the MISO market, as they call it, a market that started last April, and a new market that has more of a real-time buy and sell opportunity for electricity. And that's going to be the focus of our discussion here today, and how energy costs are sold and bought on a minute-by-minute basis, and the fluctuation in the market and how it's priced, and all those issues, and the cost of energy today certainly has been rising. And so just as some background information, I thought members were certainly informational to me, and I assumed it would probably be information that not everybody on the committee has as well. So I thought it would be a good time, and we do have quorum, so we will officially call the Regulated Industries Committee to order. And first, Representative Walker will move the approval of the minutes. Oh, she's gone.
Representative
Erickson, okay. Moves the approval of the minutes. Any questions? Debate? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion is approved. With that, we will ask Claire Moeller and Mariah White to come and give us the background of MISO. And Claire, I'll let you give a little history as we talked the other day. And Mariah, we can try to structure it to about 45 minutes is what I think would be best, as there will probably be some questions and answers as well. And then we have a couple more testifiers as well. So welcome to our committee. We're excited to hear about the MISO market and the buying and selling of energy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mariah White from the Department of Commerce. Before I turn this over to Claire, who will be the main speaker, my comments are very short, Mr. Chair and members. I'll just give a little background on regulatory activities that we've had in the state, being involved with MISO, and various things of that sort. Claire will be your main event, talking about what MISO is. So I will turn it over to Claire. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Claire Moeller with the Midwest Independent Transmission System Operator, affectionately known as MISO. That's easier to say and doesn't mean much.
So it really should be MITSO.
MITSO, yeah. But for whatever reason, when they did the logo, they forgot the T. In any event, what I thought I'd do is start with some context from which MISO was formed. In the middle 80s, in the entire country, there were a lot of high-cost generation stations, nuclear plants predominantly. There was a general curtailment of load growth and quite a lot of chaos in the utility industry. Most states began to insist that their utilities bid for new capacity and energy as part of that landscape. In 1978, there was a Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act was passed in an effort to open up the energy market to small interests, predominantly hydropower, biomass, those sorts of small energy producers. What occurred at the federal level was complaints of abuse of market power that the incumbent utilities either inadvertently or with intent sought to preclude these new kinds of generators from entering the marketplace. Because of those complaints about unfair access, the FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, proceeded on a rulemaking set in an attempt to open the market to additional energy resources. In 1992, there was an Electric Policy Act that caused electric utilities to open their transmission systems to third-party use under what is referred to an Open Access Transmission Tariff, or OATT. That Open Access Transmission Tariff was intended to, again, improve the openness of the transmission system so that additional third-party generators could have access to move their generation to buyers. At the time, there were complaints that some transmission owners were manipulating their transmission capacities to preclude the transmission of energy across their system. Finally, in 1996, the FERC wrote a rule called 888 and 889, which caused the utilities to separate the employees that were managing their transmission grids from the employees that were buying and selling energy in an attempt to make a level playing field in that energy marketplace. At the time, these ISOs, which is where the ISO and MISO came from, were formed around, the FERC, in the way they dealt with these situations, made turning over the capacity and the management of that transmission capacity to independent system operators a voluntary exercise for utilities. But if they wanted permission to do anything else from FERC, they would volunteer to do so. So it was quite coercive to the point where it's the notion of voluntary is a somewhat dubious distinction. Unfortunately, complaints of market power abuse persisted after the formation of these independent system operators, and subsequently, the FERC promulgated a rule called FERC Order 2000, which formed Regional Transmission Organizations, or RTOs. The Midwest ISO sought status as a regional transmission organization and achieved that status as the first RTO approved by the FERC in the country. The mission of the RTO is to ensure a level playing field for participants in the energy marketplace. That is, that access is comparably granted to both incumbent utilities and new entrants in the energy marketplace. Among the functions that the FERC insisted on in terms of the RTO's exercise of that management was to achieve an economic basis for deciding what energy transactions might be on the transmission grid at any given time. That gave rise to what is in place today in terms of the Midwest ISO energy market. The notion behind that market is a notion called locational marginal pricing, or LMP, where at any given point in the system there is a price at which energy can be purchased. And then when the system is fully subscribed, the most cost-effective transactions are maintained. Inside that portfolio of cost transactions, there are many different strategies that an energy supplier might bring. Everything from becoming what the market calls a price taker, which is a way to say that regardless what the energy price is, that unit will be dispatched first. that's an effective way to give that unit priority of dispatch within the marketplace. Two, a combustion turbine, for example, which may have a very high marginal cost and would only be used at, you know, at a time of system peak or at a time when the transmission system were fully subscribed. The Midwest ISO's energy market began in April of last year. We spent 2 months in shakedown, if you will, where only cost-based offers and bids were allowed. The market-based offers and bids began to be allowed in June, and so we've got from April through now, so almost a year of operational service underneath our experience. I do have a handout, Mr. Chairman, that I'd like to provide.
We got a page who will come and deliver it. Thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, thanks for the bread, Michael.
He didn't make it. We're okay to eat it.
Mr. Chair and members, if I could interject on what Claire's talking about right now, the impact, the direct impact to Minnesota that Claire is giving you the history of is that the series of federal rulings and laws that the federal government passed through since the 70s through the 80s, into the 90s, and into the 2000s, basically, one of the things they did basically was to ensure that generators of different types and different sizes were not discriminated against in their ability to hook up to the electric grid. And the impact for that for Minnesota, as you know, is we've had we have a lot of wind development in the state that have happened in the last 10 years, and we're hopefully that development will continue. And that the value of MISO is that they control things and control interconnections such that they ensure that discrimination does not happen for smaller projects or other renewable projects versus a potential utility-owned big power plant. So that's, I think, one of the definite impacts, and that's one of the important things that MISO brings to the table for the state of Minnesota. That I think Mr. Chair wanted you committee members to be aware of as you look at different requests and pieces of legislation having to do with renewables. This is just background for you. Thank you, and I'll quit talking now and turn it back to Claire.
All right. I like you talking. It gave me an opportunity to get a glass of water. Sorry for the interruption. I'd like to move our discussion now from the history of the Midwest ISO and some of the whys that it was formed to a little more about how it works. Prior to the Midwest ISO energy market, there was an energy market that was quite active in the region. But that energy marketplace was what we call a bilateral marketplace. That is, individual buyers and sellers among the utilities made energy transactions. And there was a significant amount of energy traded between these entities. Unfortunately, in that sort of market, there is no price discovery. So it's not possible for third parties to understand what the cost of those transactions are. So with the advent of the Midwest ISO energy market, what has occurred is utilities now have essentially four choices instead of two. Prior to the marketplace, their choices were to generate their own energy or purchase in a bilateral fashion from a counterparty, either an independent power producer or another utility. After the market was formed, those two alternatives still exist. They can generate their own energy. They can purchase from an individual, on an individual basis bilaterally. They can purchase energy from a pool of energy offers on a day-ahead basis, that is, today for tomorrow, or they can purchase energy on a 5-minute increment, which is what we call a real-time energy marketplace. Those last two elements, the day-ahead market and the real-time market, achieve price discovery, and those prices are available to the public at large. The excerpt that I've handed out are like 7 pages of a report that the Midwest ISO publishes on its website monthly about what the price trends in the various regions that we serve are. The data that I pulled and provided for you is for what we call the Minnesota Hub. That is the energy trades in aggregate that happen in our physical geographic region. With that in mind, I'd like to draw your attention to a few of the slides that will help give you an understanding of what that marginal price or value of energy might be in any given hour. The second page of the handout, which is labeled page 47, that's 47 of a 98-page report. I saved you the bother of the first 46 pages. That's a trend line that began in April of 2005 when our market began through February of this year. What those trends represent is the fluctuation of price of energy inside that Minnesota hub from lows that approach very low numbers to highs that approach over $200 per megawatt hour. This particular trend line is an opportunity to see the volatility of those prices day to day, hour to hour.
Mr. Mueller, just to break that down, $200 a megawatt hour would equate to about 20 cents a kilowatt?
That's correct.
Okay. Just for members, that's kind of a term that at least my simple brain and my utility bill connect with. So. But
I do apologize.
No, I just wanted to make that clear.
We tend to speak in dollars per megawatt hour, and it does equate to cents per kilowatt hour. The page 47, that's an on-peak price fluctuation. The definition of on-peak is essentially the daylight hours. The next page, then, is a fluctuation of off-peak prices. And what you'll see, notably, in some hours, the price is negative. What that says is if a generator were to reduce its output, there's an opportunity to buy less expensive energy on the marketplace. But there can be very good reasons for not doing that. For example, if it's a run-of-river hydro plant, it would not make sense to reduce the output during those hours because you would be wasting water. And so in that kind of situation, it would be illogical to not generate during that time frame. There are other similar kinds of reasons. If there might be a generating plant that is at its low output point because of its environmental permits, to go lower than that would cause it to violate its air permits, for example. And again, that would be an illogical result. So while those prices on the off-peak show negative on the margin, that isn't to say that those choices were poor choices on behalf of the generator. If I could then draw your attention to the next page, which is a perhaps easier way to think about the prices. Page 55 is what we call a price duration curve. This particular price duration curve shows the average kinds of prices in the real-time market, that is the 5-minute purchase opportunities for the on-peak period from through February of 2006. So those on-peak prices, the way to read this particular graph is if you look at the 50% line on the horizontal axis, that says that 50% of the time the price of energy in the real-time market was $40 per megawatt hour or more, 4 cents, and 50% of the time it was less than that, with the minimum being essentially zero for 1 hour. if you proceed to the next page and we look at the off-peak prices average for Minnesota, you'll see that 80% of the time, the off-peak prices for energy were $20 or more in those off-peak periods, where the $40 or more only occurred about 10% of the time.
Representative Hoppe, you have a question?
Yeah, just a quick question. Mr. Chair, going back to page 55, the previous slide, how come Minnesota is so much higher than the other states listed here, and then at the very end a little bit lower when you get down to the 100% mark?
Sure. See, it's higher and lower. On an average basis, the Minnesota hub's average price is less than the other three hubs that we serve. What happens in those very high hours, the transmission system that serves Minnesota is often constrained. That is, cheaper energy can't get to our customers during some hours, and it's those constraints that cause that high price.
Thank you.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Mueller, then what if we're reading this chart right, that happens somewhat less than 5% of the time. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thanks.
The graphs that we just went through have to do with those five-minute prices rather than the day-ahead price.
Okay.
It is logical to expect those five-minute prices to be very volatile. It's the nature of that 5 minutes. If we move to page 57.
Representative Hilke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we move away from page 55, I would just like to ask if there is any relationship at all between the high price that we see here and the high cost that might be incurred in delivering it.
These prices for the highest hours tend to be driven across this last year by the extraordinarily high prices we had for natural gas as a fuel. The peak consumption of electricity is generally fired by gas-fired combustion turbines. After Hurricane Katrina, we had gas prices that were up to five times what they'd been in the previous year. So predominantly what happens is, because cheaper energy can't get to our consumers, we have to use more local generation that's fired by expensive fuels, natural gas and oil.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Mueller, are you saying then that if we had to rely on natural gas all the time, that the price would be that high?
Yes, sir.
Good question.
Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Hilke, can I just
step
in? I think what Claire's statement is correct, but it's correct considering the price of the gas at the time that these prices were experienced. So what we would have to do is we would have to look at the market price of natural gas in consideration of the price of the energy at the time. And if the price of gas goes down, then the price of the energy will go down. Even
in this number, it's an all-in number, Mr. Mueller or Ms. White?
No, it's not.
Is it $200 a megawatt?
The $200 a megawatt hour represents only the incremental fuel and the variable operation and maintenance cost of these units. The all-in price would have to include the cost of the machine itself, and that's not part of the Midwest ISO energy market.
Oh, I see. So this price doesn't reflect the capital cost that the power generator had to put up to?
That's correct.
So where do they recover that cost?
Mr. Chair, for regulated utilities, the cost of the infrastructure
is paid by the rate payers.
Is paid in their base rates.
In their base
rates. Right. And they, okay. and they
so they basically don't have a cost on the generator when they're selling it on the market like this.
When they're selling or buying from the market.
Representative Hilke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess the question that I asked initially, I just need to back up one step. If the high cost of electricity in certain periods is related to the high cost of natural gas, then the question I guess would be, is the high cost of natural gas at that point in any way related to the cost of delivering it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, do you mean delivering the natural gas to, say, the power plants? Is that what you're talking about?
Representative Hilty.
What I'm saying is, that's one way that you could put it. It just strikes me as curious that we see such price spikes in times of need when I'm not aware that there are such spikes in our ability to deliver the product.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Hilty, the prices for example, interstate natural gas pipelines charge to deliver natural gas from the production area, which for us is either Alberta, Canada, or southern U.S., Gulf of Mexico. Those prices are regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and are fairly stable. The utilities contract for those on either a seasonal basis or an annual basis, but those are pretty constant, those prices. The volatility that we see is actually the open market commodity price for the natural gas itself, which is not regulated. That's an open market price that you see traded on NYMEX, just like grains and different things like that.
So, Mr. Chair, in other words, it's just the principle involved here is all the market will bear.
I'm still pondering. Representative Hilty. Mr. Mueller, please proceed so we can stay on track here.
Thank you. If I could direct your attention to page 57. On page 57, they are the similar kind of statistics, only this shows about the day-ahead energy market. That would be the price discovery for energy purchased today for tomorrow. What we see in that case is there's less volatility, that is, less fluctuation both up and down, and generally speaking, the price in the day-ahead market is marginally more expensive than the price in the real-time market on average. So what happens in the real-time market is a lot of volatility and averaging a slightly lower cost in the day-ahead market. Because of the certainty of delivery, there's a premium paid against that certainty, and that's what causes that price to be marginally higher.
Mr. Mueller, Minnesota's higher than the other areas on average, it appears. What is that? Is that a correct reading, or what's the reason for that?
That is a correct reading in the day-ahead market. That has to do with the amount of transmission constraints we have in terms of our ability to move energy into and out of the region. And it's also a recognition that, again, now this tends to be the marginal energy, not the average energy cost of all energy produced and consumed. So this is the last megawatt hour's cost, not the average megawatt hour's cost.
I see. Representative Beard, does that answer your question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I didn't actually have a question.
Oh, I thought I heard you say, Mr. Chair.
No, but that was enlightening information. Thank you.
Go ahead.
The next page, then, is the same analytics for the off-peak period of time, which is the nighttime hours. This particular report is refreshed monthly. Again, it has in its entirety just short of 100 pages of information. It includes similar kinds of information for Illinois, for Michigan, for Ohio. It shows how the Midwest ISO energy marketplace compares to the Pacific Jersey, Maryland, or PJM marketplace, and how we compare to the New York and New England marketplaces. On average, the Midwest ISO markets energy trades slightly less than, as in lower price than, those other marketplaces. That has predominantly to do with the fact that our mix of generation has more coal baseload, nuclear baseload kinds of resources as an average than those marketplaces further to our east. They rely more heavily on natural gas than we do.
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I was at the airport a couple, 3 weeks ago, and the lady behind the desk found out I was a legislator. And she got this look on her face, and I knew I was in for a hard time. And I thought it was going to be about Northwest Airlines, but I was surprised to find that she had complaints about her electrical energy costs going up, which I was impressed with. But we've been hearing reports of increases of 14, 16, 25%. Especially among businesses. And I'm just wondering, since April of 2005, since you've been on, that we've been buying essentially on the spot market electrical energy to a certain degree. I wonder if that has anything to do with the increase of costs to our residents and businesses.
Mr. Moore?
Thank you. I'll answer first, and perhaps Mariah has a different opinion. In the case of the energy marketplace, the spot market, real-time, and the day-ahead spot market are tools that are in addition to the traditional utilities tools of purchasing energy in a bilateral market or producing it themselves. So in and of itself, the notion of the bilateral market being augmented by these other two markets would not appear to be a cause for that price to go up. It is true that across the last year, the commodity price of coal, not so much the coal itself, but the delivery of that coal because of the run-up in oil prices, diesel fuel, we have estimates that run between 25 and 40% inflation on coal. And on natural gas, we've got between it was about $4 going into the summer, and it peaked out around 15. So we had a magnitude of four times on gas, and we had a magnitude of 30 to 40% on coal, delivered coal. And it's that fuel inflation that has driven substantial changes in the energy market that are affecting the entire nation.
Sure. Representative Baird.
Mr. Moore, and so am I given to understand that in a given ton of coal, transportation is that much of the cost versus the raw coal itself?
Depending on how far away you are from the mine, depending on how effectively the utility chose to hedge its transportation costs, yes, sir.
Wow. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Powell.
Well, thank you for that. And that's an interesting observation on that, and I hadn't thought of that before. My question had been, I thought perhaps maybe if we could keep off the spot market by by building more baseload generation, that may be a better way to keep costs down. But given your answer, perhaps not as much as what we would like. Would that be a fair statement?
Mr. Moeller.
You can start. I'll try second.
All right.
Ms. White.
With your indulgence, Mr. Chair and Representative Powell.
I didn't hear the question, so I'm not even sure. Your answer can be right or wrong.
I think we have to look at baseload generation and what we call intermediate, which is seasonal generation, which is usually combined cycle natural gas, which is much more efficient use of the natural gas, and peaking natural gas plants, which the beauty of that is when everybody turns their air conditioners on in August, you can turn a combustion turbine natural gas plant on very quickly to meet those air conditioners. And you can turn it off very quickly when the air conditioners go down. So that's the function of the three types of plants. I think it's important for each of the utilities to pay close attention, and I think they do, pay close attention to the types of customers they have, the numbers of customers they have, and their customers' usage and usage patterns of electricity, and match those as best they can with the types of facilities they need, and also the types of transmission they need to move that power to the customers when the customers want it. I think that Buying in the spot market, I think, is a very valuable tool for customers, especially when utilities, all utilities, be they regulated, state regulated or not, look at the weather every day and try their best guess based upon NOAA forecasts and all of the other forecasts what the day's weather is going to be so they can anticipate their customers' needs. But we all know that Chinooks happen and things like that, and all of a sudden the weather can go nuts, and nobody can really predict that. So I think in times like that, being able to purchase energy off the spot market, I think, is a very valuable tool. I don't know if I would depend on the real-time market for a large majority of our customers' needs, simply because in case a number of power plants go down, there might not be that much energy left in the real-time market left to purchase. And I'm not saying that would happen, but it could. So we don't want to, you know, bargain or not run short when our customers want energy. But I think we should use the real-time market. I think we should use the day ahead. I think we should look at transmission. I think when we get short of energy, of the amount of energy the customers need every day, all day and all night, we need to look at baseload fixes. And then when we look at baseload fixes and we build facilities like that, we probably have to shore up the transmission system to support facilities like that. So we need to look at all of those pieces together in a portfolio. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, and it does, I think, to a certain extent. But I believe that, you know, just as a closing comment, is that when you look at what happened in California here a few years ago, they didn't build baseload generation for 30 years or more. They were buying off the spot market. They were paying at times as much as $1 a kilowatt hour. And, you know, you had a couple big plants need maintenance, and things just kind of fell apart. And so sooner or later, now we're going to need to build more baseload here. And I'm just wondering, are we there yet? Or is this something that, you know, is going to have to happen within the next 6 years, 15 years? Because we certainly don't want to get in that type of situation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Collin, members, I think we are very close to that point now. Each of the regulated utilities and the generation and transmission utilities that serve electric co-ops have to, every 2 years, provide integrated resource plans to the Public Utilities Commission, which is basically an estimate of their load, which is the number of customers and their type of customers and usage for the next 15 years, and the amount of energy and types of energy they'll need to meet that load. And we monitor those, analyze them quite carefully, and we are seeing that some of our largest utilities are definitely to the point within the next decade, they're going to have to build some baseload, or there's going to have to be baseload available to them, either for building, they'll have to build it, or they'll have to purchase it.
Mr. Chairman, if I might amplify.
Mr. Mueller.
Additional things to contemplate as we think about the amount of baseload generation that would be appropriate. In historical times, utilities tended to plan those units around only their own load, and the result of that had a different kind of cost effect than in today's world, where they can contemplate the construction of that baseload plant and for a period of time make some excess capacity, if you will, in some months available to display some of those higher spot market prices. So there's an opportunity because of the size of the Midwest ISO market. To give you an idea about that, XL Energy's service territory in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and the Dakotas represents on peak something just short of 9,000 megawatts of load. The Midwest ISO's marketplace is 120,000 megawatts of load. So given sufficient transmission to make sure that those plants can be fully utilized, there are some strategic differences today with the access to sell into that market than was available prior to the Midwest ISO's marketplace.
And Mr. Chair, and if I could, looking over there at our wind folks, our wind friends, I would like to just talk about where wind and renewable energy fits into this whole mix. The MISO market, the transmission market, the way MISO, and Claire needs to correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding the way MISO handles wind generation. Wind generation is a wonderful energy source for megawatt hours, but it only, those turbines only move when the wind blows. So we can depend on them a certain amount, but not all the time. And we can't turn them on. I mean, Claire cannot sit in his dispatch room and expect to kick over wind turbines. It just doesn't work. But when those wind turbines are moving, MISO accepts wind energy first before it accepts energy from other plants. That's another thing that didn't necessarily, I don't think we had the capabilities to do that prior to MISO and their huge computing capability. But that's another benefit to the state of Minnesota and our developing wind industry that we have now under MISO, and MISO does do that. They accept wind energy, and if there's capacity constraints on the line, they will accept the wind energy, and they will back off other plants to take it.
So how do they, I assume the price is the same then? I mean, if you're producing wind electricity, you're getting, on the spot market, you're getting what the market would be. Is that right? I mean, what the market is at that current time?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The way most of the wind energy projects are currently working in the marketplace, and perhaps when the representatives from Great River Energy are here, they can amplify on this answer. What has typically happened is there's a power purchase arrangement between one of the local utilities and a wind development project. The utility essentially fronts the risk of that price volatility, and we accept the wind machines because the value in the wind machines is producing energy when the energy is available. So we've structured their entrant in the market at what we call a price taker that says we will accept that energy, and the value of that energy is whatever it is at that point all the way to zero. Now, the reality is that energy has been generally picked up by one of the local utilities, so that the actual value the wind developer is getting for that energy is not zero. All it's saying is that at that particular time, the marginal value of that energy is no more than what it would have been. It is also possible for a wind developer to produce energy on that price taker status without the benefit of a power purchase agreement. That would require some different kinds of relationships with their financial institutions. Generally speaking, those sorts of financing options where a developer is selling purely into the market haven't occurred. But as the market develops and the prices in that market become predictable, we believe that's another option that can be explored in terms of the financing and the viability of wind projects.
And prior to the MISO market a year ago, that wouldn't have been a possibility.
Prior to the MISO market, that was not a possibility. The only way to get that wind to market was within a power purchase agreement. Okay. Now, while we're at wind, we should take a moment to talk about the fact that the transmission system in the physical region where wind is most appropriately developed is at its full capacity. And so there's a lot of difficulty in currently getting that wind to market because those transmission lines are fully subscribed.
Where is that? The southwest corner of the state?
Southwest corner of the state, on through the Dakotas.
What about more western and northern and southeastern part of Minnesota?
As you move to the southeast, it is constrained, but not as severely. As you move towards the load centers in the state, there are less constraints locally.
Mr. Chair and Commissioners, just to let you know, Xcel Energy has just given the commission notice that it's going to build a couple of more 115 kV lines. Those aren't huge lines, but they're a good size to hook wind projects to, and they have given the commission notice that they will be constructing three more. I think it's three. Is it three? Yeah, three more 115 kV lines around the Buffalo Ridge area to accommodate more wind development. So that's coming very soon.
It's also true that in the Otter Tail proposal to build their Big Stone generation, the outlet capability of the Big Stone generation, as they've filed for, is capacity, transmission capacity in excess what would be minimally required for the Big Stone unit, in anticipation of working to allow more wind to be developed in the Buffalo Ridge area and get to market.
So, Mr. Moeller, I had asked earlier this week when we talked about if somebody was going to sell wind just without a purchase agreement, do you have an average of what they would have received throughout the year or at all, or is that figure?
Yeah, the curves that I provided, one of the things that I wasn't able to understand in terms of physically when the wind energy, what its profile is in terms of on-peak and off-peak.
Mm-hmm.
But if you would refer to the real-time price duration curves that I provided earlier, sir, on pages on page 55, for example, what page 55 says is that 60% of the time the value of that energy would have been $40 or more. And so by taking the wind duration curve against the price duration curve, it would be possible for a developer to estimate on an hour-by-hour basis what the value of that energy might be. This data is also available hour-by-hour, very, very granularly on this website that any developer can access and use to make their own estimates in terms of what the average value of the energy would be that they would produce.
Okay. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Mr. Moeller, a couple questions. The first, dealing with FERC, and another one about the MISO Q, which people in my area of the state talk about the MISO Q. I believe it's correct to say that the FERC has issued orders rejecting exemptions from the standard interconnection rule for wind generators that were sought by you, MISO, and the New York independent system operator. And some of this gets into terms that you might have more familiarity with than I do regarding the low voltage ride through and reactive power provisions for wind generators. That you had requested standard reactive power requirements on these wind generators, and the wind energy advocates argued that FERC should maintain the need-based approach rather than the requirement for this low-voltage ride-through and the change in to the standard reactive power. And then the advocates advocated that this approach would avoid the wasted investment in places where the capability that you are requesting from FERC is not needed. And how does that relate to, we talk about, and there's pending in Minnesota, an interconnection study and how much can be put on the grid and not compromise reliability. Is it necessary to, well, FERC obviously said it wasn't, in their ruling, to have this reactive power requirement on wind generators. Could you address that? And then I've got another one on the queue.
Sure. Mr. Moeller. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The notion behind the FERC rejecting the standardization doesn't reject the fact that it is often necessary for those low-voltage ride-through capabilities to be in existence. our experience as we've evaluated the wind interconnection requests in our region indicate that because we tend to connect those wind machines in places where the transmission system is very weak, the weakness of that transmission system argues for including those ride-through capabilities. In the early days on Buffalo Ridge, there were significant operating problems where a low-voltage ride-through was not part of the criteria. And on a remote transmission event, all the wind machines would trip on a low-voltage event, and it caused significant operating trouble in western Minnesota. So the Midwest ISO's position was that because every time we had looked at a wind interconnection, this low-voltage ride-through capability was a requirement based on the geography and the physics of the facts in front of us, that it would make sense for that to be a standard that everyone should follow. The FERC's finding was that because everyone's fact circumstance was not the same fact circumstance that we face, that it was an inappropriate thing to cause all wind machines to always have to provide that ride-through capability, and instead we will continue to location by location evaluate whether or not that ride-through capability is required.
No, thank you. I just wonder how that will play into our interconnection or any wind integration study that we're all in waiting for.
If I might, the wind integration study is looking not so much at the low voltage ride-through kinds of capabilities, which have to do with generation machines performance during storms and those sorts of things. The wind integration study has more to do with how much wind in its uncontrollable kind of parameters can we safely integrate and maintain control of the electric system simultaneously.
Yes. Okay. And if I may follow up,
Representative
Chairman Westrom, I've got, and I don't know if it's the current one or if it's just the one that's, I've got these flow chart or spreadsheet, Microsoft Excel, I suppose, relating to the queue number, the queue date, the control area, the study zone, the county, the state, then the megawatt outputs. And if you add up the eight states in the MISO queue, this is for coal only, it comes to 18,457 megawatts of coal that's in the queue. I mean, dates going back to 1999 and dates in the queue, 05, 04, 05, 06. I'm just wondering, how does this, I mean, is that all going to be built? Or how is that, I guess my question is, from what I hear from the developers for wind projects where I'm from, is that they always talk about the MISO queue and where you are in the queue and how there's coal in the queue that keeps wind out of the queue and not realistically considered in the queue, considering that, you know, there's proposals for 18,500 megawatts in an eight-state area. Does filling up the queue by paying for the MISO study effectively displace development of wind as it applies to the queue position, the queue date? If you could,
Mr. Muller,
explain to me some of that, the queue dynamic, if you will.
Sure. I'll try. It is a complicated monster.
Yeah. For the committee, it's not that easy to read.
The federal energy tariff that we need to follow in terms of allowing comparable access to the transmission system says first come, first serve. It doesn't say, if you're willing to pay the money for the study, your project is viable. Okay. Prior to insisting that people pay for their studies up front, we did have places where we suspected people were tying up the queue without the project being real. Our experience since we've been insisting on pay up front has been that those projects, nobody puts $50,000 down unless it's a real deal, has been our experience. There are cases where the $50,000 reveals that it costs $50 million of transmission to make that project viable, and then those projects will exit. In our region, the only coal plant that I'm aware of in the western part of the region that is in the queue at the moment is the Big Stone project, and Big Stone is a very real coal project with the developers of that coal project being very serious. We have subsequently to the Big Stone process, there is the Excelsior project, which is a coal gasification project rather than a traditional coal, and those developers, at least in our estimation, are similarly very serious. So at least in our region, we do not see that there are unserious entrants in that queue that are somehow manipulating the queue. We have attempted, in terms of particularly the wind requests in our region, to speed that process up. So rather than it being a one-at-a-time kind of process, we've sought to group them in terms of similar locations and similar times. We currently have the wind projects grouped in, I believe it's three different groupings. So we're trying to compress that time and get folks' answers in an expedited manner. When we group those projects, everyone isn't always happy about that either. If your queue position was early, you don't like the grouping process because you think, well, maybe I could have got on for free.
Mm-hmm.
Where if you're the last guy in the grouping, you think this is a great idea because you got the other 47 projects helping you. But in terms of the infrastructure required, if we're going to effectively exploit the volumes of wind that state policy suggests we need to be prepared to exploit, it's important that we look at those projects in aggregate and at the end of the day construct a transmission system that can accommodate a robust amount of that wind resource in the portfolio.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you for that. And Mr.
Bell, to follow up one more time.
Well, make it quick.
I know. Thank you. We got a new gambling as well.
Fires.
So you got on the one I'm looking at: South Dakota, North Dakota. Otter Tail 600 at Big Stone, Minnesota Power, or no, this is WAUE, whoever that is, Clay, South Dakota. 600 megawatts there. 600 megawatts, Minnesota Power. Then GRE 80. A new unit at the Stanton Station, and then you got 606 at the Minnesota Power Blackberry, 800 at or near Hibtac Sub, 800 at or near Mintac Sub, and it just goes. How much of that is, I don't know, you put your 50 grand in, you get your spot in the queue, and if you can maybe make an argument that keeps some renewables down, if you don't want to invest in the renewable, just put up 50 grand and get yourself in the queue to hold up some of the other spots, even though you did say you're grouping them.
Perhaps I should defer this question to Mariah. My obligation under the federal tariff is to treat all requesters comparably.
Mm-hmm.
And so a judgment that I might have personally about how serious one of these projects are, if I were to act on that bias, I'd like get into all kinds of trouble at FERC.
Okay, then we don't have to go any further. That's fine.
Mr. Mueller, did you have a little more to finish in testifying? I know another area that people have asked me repeatedly about is pricing of a new costs of energy and where natural gas and coal and wind and nuclear are coming in at. Do you have any averages of where we're at nowadays with costs and then with or without the fuel adjustment clause? Do you have any information on that?
I have a little information that that I might share. This information is not based on current project proposals or pricing or engineering in our region. This is literature search kind of numbers that attempt to evaluate kind of an all-in kind of cost. One of the most important things to contemplate is that our embedded generation, that is the generation that we currently enjoy, is substantially less expensive than any new generation we might construct. You know, so for example, an all-in price average for a nuclear power plant that was constructed, say, in went into service in the early 1970s, the total cost for the all-in cost, not just the marginal cost, so the cost of the equipment as well as the cost of the energy, is on the order of 3.5 cents per kilowatt hour. A current large coal plant like we enjoy is on the order of 2.5 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, what's important about some of that is the average age of a coal plant in our region is 40 years old, which typically was its original design life. So, you know, we're enjoying those very old capital costs in those prices. If we think about a new baseload kind of resource, which would be a traditional pulverized coal kind of resource similar to what the current fleet is, the new price would be between 6 to 8.5 cents per kilowatt hour for that new coal resource. Nuclear, it's a little more difficult to get anybody that's willing to give you a price because a lot of the costs are political costs, which are difficult to quantify. If you do a Google search on nukes, you get numbers that come back for a new nuclear plant on the order of from 5 to 7 cents per kilowatt hour for the all-in cost.
Where do natural gas and wind fall in that same cost alignment?
The dispatchable intermediate resources, which is that combined cycle, which is a fairly efficient way to use gas at current kinds of gas prices, nominally the like $9 per MMBTU, is on the average of 5.5 to 9 cents. Per kilowatt hour. The in a natural gas combustion turbine is 11 to 15 cents. Now, those last two are driven largely by the price of the commodity itself. The capital cost, the equipment cost of a combustion turbine are on the order of $400 per kilowatt of capacity installed. So it's pretty cheap, and then it's a high cost to operate the plant. Where if you look at a coal plant, the numbers are more like $2,000 per kilowatt of installed capacity, but the energy cost is quite cheap. So there's a significant trade-off between those two in terms of marginal energy cost or not. So if you construct a baseload plant, you want to expect that it operates 60 to 90% of the time producing its full output in order to make that cost trade-off make sense.
Okay.
Now, a wind machine, which is what your real question was. Now, it's important to make the distinction between dispatchable and non-dispatchable. Again, you know, a wind machine is an important source of energy, but its lack
baseload.
Yeah, but its lack of dispatchability gives it a different kind of value in terms of the system. You need to have these dispatchable kinds of resources to make sure you can balance generation to load. A large wind development would be on the order of 3.5 to 4 cents per kilowatt hour. In a more modest kind of wind development, the upside is a little higher. It's in the 3 to 5 cent kind of range. Because you lose some economies of scale as the size of the wind development reduces.
With that, Mr. Moeller and Ms. White, I think we better bring forward two other testifiers that have asked to be on the list, and then Rick Lancaster and Dan Jewell. If you two can stay nearby, we may have questions that would come up, but why don't Dan and Rick come up together, and we can hear from them. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rick Lancaster. I'm Vice President of Generation with Great River Energy. Would you like me to go first, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Thank you. The page is handing out an outline of my comments, but I could also at the end address some of the questions that were asked of Mr. Moeller and Ms. White. First, I think most of you are familiar with Great River Energy, so I'll keep the background brief. We're a not-for-profit generation and transmission electric cooperative. We serve 28 member distribution cooperatives who have about 600,000 retail members, in other words, households and businesses that they serve in Minnesota. We have 2,500 megawatts of load and generation, about 118 megawatts, exactly 118 megawatts of purchased wind power. We are a MISO member, so we're a member of the organization that Mr. Moeller represents and works for, and we are accustomed to using the MISO transmission interconnection processes and the MISO market. I'll use the Trimont Wind Project as kind of a case study of a recent wind project we brought online. It's a 100-megawatt project that went into service this past November near Trimont, Minnesota. It's owned by TPM Energy, but was originally developed and proposed to us by landowners in that area who retain an economic interest in the project in addition to the lease payments that they receive for the towers and turbines that are on their land. The pricing for that project was bid into us in a bidding process that we also call a request for proposals process. The price, I'm under confidentiality agreement, so I can't reveal the price to you, but it was competitive because of the federal production tax credit that the developer as a taxable entity received, and it's part of our commitment to the renewable energy objective. Trimont first came about because in March of 2003 we issued a request for proposals. The next month in April we received a lot of proposals, began an evaluation and negotiation period with the proposers, and in March of 2004 the Great River Energy Board of Directors approved the project. In July of 2004 the Rural Utilities Service of the United States Department of Agriculture approved the project. We could not go forward without their approval. And in November of last year, it began commercial operation. Now let me talk a little bit about MISO and how it relates to a project like that. MISO provides a benefit, in my opinion, because it creates a standardized procedure for interconnection to the transmission system. Regardless of what utility you're interconnecting with, if you're a wind developer, as long as they're a MISO member, there's the same standardized procedure for interconnecting with the system. That's a good thing for us and a good thing for wind developers. MISO also provides a second function. It's a clearinghouse for wholesale electric energy transactions. We're actively involved on an hourly basis, 8,760 hours in a year, unless it's leap year, and then there's 24 more hours in the year. We're actively involved in that hourly market, and what we can provide to wind developers is we provide risk mitigation to them. In the case of Trimont, the developer is selling the energy to us at an established price, and we then sell it into MISO, and we absorb the risk of the fluctuations in the MISO market. As Mr. Moeller said, the prices can be negative in that market, which means they don't want any more of your generation. If you put it in anyway, you got to pay them. Prices can be high or low or negative. So we stand, in the case of the Trimont project, we stand in between the project developer who needs a an established price in order to secure their financing, and the MISO market, which has a very variable price. And we can take care of that price risk for the developer, and in the case of the Trimont project, we do. Wind power that we're working on today, in October of 2005, we issued another request for proposals for 120 megawatts of wind power, including 20 megawatts of seabed, which is community-based energy development that was part of a bill passed by the legislature. We did get some seabed proposals, and we're actively negotiating with those seabed proposers and with others based on proposals that we received on December 16th. We hope to have those projects in service by the end of 2007. Now let me address a couple of questions. One that was asked by Representative Powell, he asked about baseload generation. Mr. Moeller referred to the Big Stone 2 project. We are a partner in that also, along with Otter Tail Power Company and five other utilities in this region. That's a 600 megawatt plant. Our share of it would be 116 megawatts. It's in South Dakota, 2 miles from Minnesota and 2 miles from our service area served by Agrilite Electric Cooperative. We have filed a certificate of need application both in South Dakota and in Minnesota for that project, and we hope to have it online if we secure the permits in 2011. So that is a baseload generation plant that we would like to build to serve our baseload needs. Representative Peterson asked about the MISO queue, and the Big Stone is in the MISO queue. We will pay for the transmission that we need out of that plant, as Mr. Moeller alluded to, plus additional transmission that we will pay for to facilitate wind power outlet out of that region and to be part of the CapEx transmission projects from Buffalo Ridge to Metro. So Big Stone is not getting in the way of any wind power in that region. In fact, it's facilitating purposely on our part, facilitating additional wind power outlet out of the region. And that's all that I wanted to say, Mr. Chair. I'd be glad to answer questions.
Okay. Any questions? Otherwise, what I would suggest, Mr. Jewell, why don't we have you testify, and then we can open it up for a few questions at the end, and we need to try to wrap this portion up by 4 o'clock. So that's what we're aiming for.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I take that means quickly, right?
Yeah. Please identify yourself for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Dan Jewell. I'm here today representing CBED, which is the Community-Based Energy Development Group. It's a nonprofit organization that helps farmers and small businesses do renewable energy projects out in rural Minnesota. And I came to talk about the avoided cost and the pricing mechanisms that are set up when we look at energy pricing and how the power purchase contracts for renewable energy are basically looked at. And I have quite a long litany of things to look at, but given the time constraints, I'm going to go kind of quickly through it. Historically, when we talk to a utility about a power purchase contract, they talk about their avoided cost, and they always look at their historical avoided cost. But according to the state rules and the federal rules, and in Minnesota Rules Chapter 7835, they're supposed to look at years ahead at what the costs are, not just historical costs of what it used to be, historical costs of what it used to be. And it's not just an energy component, there's also a capacity component. And I know that it was talked about that wind is not dispatchable, but wind is dispatchable, it's just not predictable, and it is predictable, especially when you look at what MISO is looking at the day-ahead market. I know the California utilities look at day-ahead markets, and they look at wind energy, and they can predict that the wind is going to be blowing tomorrow, and they know that that is going to be there. And so we feel that the capacity costs need to be put into the formula of the energy pricing somehow. But in my estimation, the big thing that we're really missing when we're looking at the energy pricing components is the fuel adjustment clauses, because I, as a ratepayer, see a completely different thing than the utility sees as a cost. They don't consider the fuel adjustment as a cost to them. They just pass it on to us through our bills. It's basically a pure pass-through. And so us ratepayers are bearing all of the risk of the fuel costs of natural gas and the the risk of what the potential climate change, CO2 taxes, mercury contamination, and what are we going to do with nuclear waste? And a lot of these things are passed through to us just on the bill basis, and they're not considered part of the cost. And so when we as local producers of clean, sustainable energy want to talk about PAR contracts, we always get, well, our costs always have been 2 cents, and that's all you're going to get. But I think we need to look at there's a difference between the cost and the value on the end to the end user, which is us, of the energy costs. The discussion about the Big Stone Power Plant that Rick just talked about, I passed out an article for everybody to look at, that basically Big Stone Power Plant today has scaled back its capacity by 75% because they can't get coal. The trains aren't delivering the coal. And so we're going to build another power plant there and expose us ratepayers to even more volatile costs in the future was something we don't have a handle on. And even the plant manager says he doesn't see any light at the end of the tunnel. There's no end in sight of this problem. And so these costs and these risks have to be put into our minds when we look at that. And we have to remember the one thing about wind energy and renewable energy, especially locally produced distributed generation, is that we don't need a lot of transmission. There is no fuel. There is no transportation of fuel. And we keep all of those energy dollars in our community, which creates rural economic development, which is just a complete another added value. One other thing I want to say very briefly, Mr. Chairman, and that is that there's a study being done right now in 2005. The transmission utility planners are discussing the transmission study for the West Central corridor for the Big Stone Power Plant. And basically and quickly, I can get this information to everybody on the committee, that the results of this study says that we can add 1,200 megawatts of community-owned wind right now into the system for additional cost to us of $6 million. That's nothing. That's $1.2 billion worth of energy development for an additional cost of to the system upgrade of $6 million. And we can do 2,200 megawatts for $18 million. And basically what that 12 miles, so $6 million is about 12 miles of the big transmission line. That'll buy. 12 miles, $6 million. And we can deliver all of that energy right now into our communities and create tons of rural economic development and long-term sustainable clean energy for very minimal cost. And so we need to look at this thing as a whole and how we can deliver energy to our communities and to our state without having to spend huge piles of money on transmission lines. So that'll be in there.
Thank you, Mr. Jewell. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to your comments, Mr. Jewell, and how they might relate to the queue. The MISO queue. What you're saying is the 2,200 megawatts for 18 million through the West Central Corridor Zone study, you found 1,200 of wind into system for about six million. Is that what you just said?
Correct.
Okay. And given the total number of coal megawatts is 18,500 in the MISO area, and comments about which projects are real and which projects are not real, I heard the MISO representative say that the Big Stone project was real and that the Excelsior Energy project was serious. I think I've got that correct. So what you're telling me is we could do 2,200 megawatts or 1,200 megawatts for a lot less amount of money. So as it relates to those two projects that I mentioned in the queue, are they real projects? Or are they taking up room in the queue? That we keep seabed from being, what you're saying is dispatchable, if MISO would change their day-ahead forecasting like other utilities in the West are doing. How does that relate to what MISO just told the committee?
Mr. Jewell or Mr. Lancaster?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, with what Claire had to say about his rules under the FERC, that they have to take everybody seriously, that's the bottom line. And obviously a lot of us feel when we look at the queuing system that there's a lot of people in the queue that are playing games trying to get into position for various reasons. We know that some large wind developers, some of the corporate players, they go in and they hear that GRE or NSP is going to do a 200 megawatt bid in 2008. And they'll go in and they'll each get in line, put their $50,000, which is peanuts to them, into the play, and they'll get in line, so there'll be 1,000 to 1,500 megawatts that's queued up, because somebody might win the 200 megawatt bid. But there's nothing we can do about that. We have to follow the rules of the FERC. And, you know, hopefully that we've been talking, the CBED people have been talking to others about the state's ability to deal with the transmission system and the queuing up process, especially if we're tying in on sub-transmission level the way CBED projects do, because CBED projects plug in close to the load. They're not trying to get into the big transmission system. We're not trying to send power halfway across the state or halfway across the region, and that has a much more positive effect to the system to plug in locally.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, I assure you that if we can get the permits from the state and from South Dakota and from the federal government, the Big Stone project is real. To respond to what Mr. Jewell said about coal supply there, the Big Stone 1, which is an existing power plant, is having a dispute with the railroad right now that's being litigated at the Surface Transportation Board in Washington, so they're having some problems right now. Those are going to get resolved once that litigation is over with, and then there will be adequate supply of coal to the project.
Representative Beard.
Just a comment to that, Mr. Chair and members. I think it was a sad day in South Dakota history when the governor of the state handed the title for that old Milwaukee line to the Burlington Northern and said, here you go, run this railroad for us. I know it's the railroad days are way past their heyday, but just to the committee members and others that care, anything we can do to enhance the regional and short line railroad in this state, I think is good for all of us, particularly rural Minnesota. And I'm not that I have any interest in the Dakota Minnesota Eastern, but I know there's several other power plants that are also hurting for coal because they're captive to the Burlington system. It's not just unique to Ortonville or Big Stone at this moment, but it is a major concern that we get one carrier that controls almost all the tonnage that rolls in out of the state, whether it's coal in or grain out or whatever it is. We're putting ourselves in a precarious position. So just some random thoughts on coal supply and how that moves.
Any other questions or comments?
Be good one.
Mr. Lancaster, Mr. Jewell, it's 4 o'clock according to my watch. Thank you for your testimony and input on this issue. We'll be looking at more energy bills. I know Representative Hackworth has a mercury bill next week. Probably that will be coming for our committee. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Westerberg, the chair will take House File 3194 off the table, and bring it to the committee for discussion. Uses that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Westerberg.
I have an amendment to put the bill in the shape that we would like.
Okay, we'll hand it out. Why don't we move the amendment? Representative Westerberg moves the A.
1328X.
We got that. Representative Westerberg moves that amendment. Why don't you tell us what it is while people are getting it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, this bill is technical in nature. It's just taking care of a number of fixes in the charitable gambling arena mostly, and what this amendment is designed to do is simply to delete the provision in the bill that required an allowance for waivers. And these waivers could be required from time to time for different charitable organizations because of extenuating circumstances, things that weren't foreseen and they would apply for. They would possibly consider applying for a waiver. However, the waiver part of it has been negotiated out of the bill, and together Allied Charities and the Gambling Control Board has come to Kumbaya Land, and we have a fix to handle this particular situation, members. And what this does is it allows an organization to carry forward an amount equal to 15%.
Mm-hmm. Well, I heard it.
I think it means we can all vote aye, I think.
So, Representative Westerberg, this is the issue we talked about yesterday. Representative Seifert had a bill on it, but between yesterday and the floor, you were hoping to work it out, and that's what you've worked out.
That's correct, Mr. Chair and members, and there is one other little fix that I need to do to the bill after we adopt this amendment.
Okay, Mr. Wilson's here. And just give us a quick affirmation, both parties, on your fix.
Mr. Chair, committee member King Wilson, executive director, we worked hard over the night and we've got something that works for everybody. Thank you.
Okay, great. Mr. Barrett, thank you. And Representative Westerberg, any discussion, members, questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beard.
So Representative Westerberg, you say the fix is in on this bill then?
Representative Beard, I would say that's correct, except it's not totally done yet. We still have a little bit of piece of business to take care of with it before we send it off on its merry way.
With that, we'll vote on the amendment. Representative Westerberg renews his motion to amend to approve the AO6 1328X amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign?
No.
Motion carries. Representative Westerberg, you said you had another small fix.
Yes, members, and or Mr. Chair, members, the provision that we just passed deletes the waiver provision, but in the bill on page, it's section 7 of the bill needs to be deleted. It's just what we were doing in that section of the bill is simply allowing the authority for the gambling board to be able to approve these waivers. And so it's just a technical fix, just deleting section 7 of the bill. It's on page 8. It's actually, it starts on page 7.
Liz, would you want to give us the explanation of that?
Page 6, line, well, all of section 7. It starts on page 6 and runs through page 8, line 24. But the only reference in the section is to the authority on 8.1 and 8.2, and that's exactly what we're deleting.
Okay, so Ms. Long, do you want to restate that amendment?
Sure. Mr. Chair, the amendment is to delete Section 7 of the bill, which is page 6, lines 32 through 34, page 7, lines 1 through 35, and page 8, lines 1 through 24. And that's consistent with the amendment that was just adopted.
Okay. Any questions? Members?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a copy of the bill.
Representative Anderson needs a copy of the bill. We'll get you one in a moment.
Here.
Do I have a copy of my
here, Ponson.
Cover you, Representative Anderson?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of
the Westerberg amendment, oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Representative Westerberg, any other amendments that you know of on your bill? Any other?
No, Mr. Chair. This gets the bill in the shape that I would like, and appreciate the member's support. The motion is to move it directly to the floor.
Is there any other committee members with amendments, or is there any testimony against the bill from the audience? Seeing none, we'll take a vote on the Westerberg House File 3194 as amended. Representative Westerberg renews his motion to pass this bill to the floor as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beard. Representative Beard, the chair takes from the table House File 3100, and it's up for discussion. I understand there's one amendment, Representative Emmer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beard, how would you want to proceed? Do you want to take the amendment first, or have any more do you have any more discussion?
Actually, no, I don't. Mr. Chairman, have any further discussion? I just, when we took it off the table and recommended pass to the General Register, is that correct?
That's correct, I believe.
Okay, I suppose we should discuss the amendment. And
is the amendment out?
What's the number? Which one?
Sir?
Sir.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Emmer, tell us what your amendment does.
The amendment, why don't I preface it this way, Mr. Chairman? Thank you. I'm going to offer the D4 amendment, and I'm offering it because regulated industries, interesting committee, because gambling is a regulated industry in the state of Minnesota. And if gambling is, in fact, here to stay, it's been around for about 15 years, then I'd say first that everybody who is in the business should be treated the same. That being said, before we proceed to address Representative Beard's bill again, I don't think gambling should be here to stay. I think gambling's a bad thing. Again, we've had it for about 15 years, and while folks like to emphasize all the great financial rewards created by the lottery and economic opportunity supposedly created by lawful gaming in this state, they ignore the real social costs created by gambling. The examples are too numerous to mention, but I'll just give you one that I have personal experience with. A couple of very limited means is involved in a very serious car accident. They suffer some serious and permanent injuries, which they negotiate a resolution of that should take care of them with their medical bills and with their lost opportunities, their ability to work, for many years to come. They settled their case for about $130,000, which should have been plenty for many years to come. Within 12 months, Mr., and their names aren't important today, had gambled everything away to the point where he was $5,000 in debt. Gambling's a bad thing. And what I'm proposing with this amendment is a prohibition of gambling in the state of Minnesota. It would be all forms of gaming, and it's basically a sunset provision that would allow folks to wind down their gaming activities over the next couple of years. With the final deadline, I believe, and you can probably read it, my glasses aren't on, I believe it's 2009.
Eight.
Is it 8?
Yep.
Maybe I need your help, Tori. 2008.
Nine.
I was right the first time. There it is. Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Okay. Representative Emmer?
That's the amendment that I move.
That's the amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins.
I assume we've done away with the 24-hour rule?
We had this amendment in our package or in our possession yesterday.
It's also
how long is this amendment?
half a page.
I looked in my packet. I would have thought that something substantive like that we would have had an opportunity to see. But Representative Emmer, if I might, how does this affect the compact? Is it revisited to find out if we can undo the compact?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Adkins, if you take a look at the proposed amendment, it applies to all forms of gaming. If you look at lines starting at 1.5 through 1.9, it's for the purposes of this section, gambling includes any game involving chance, consideration, and prize, and includes but is not limited to pari-mutuel betting under Minnesota statutes, and they're cited, lawful gambling under Minnesota statutes, and they're cited, gambling authorized through any state tribal compact and the state lottery under the referenced Minnesota statute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins.
The question I have is are there any constitutional problems or any issues with respect to trying to get out of once the state enters into a contract or in this case a compact, any difficulty getting out of that? And then secondly, I assume your goal then is to shut down Canterbury Downs as far as any horse racing and card clubs there, as well as the Minnesota State Lottery and any revenues derived from that for be it hunting, fishing, wildlife, education, whatever it might be, as well as all forms of charitable gambling. Is my understanding correct, Mr. Emmer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Adkins, actually there's a whole bunch of questions you just asked me, and why don't I address the first one that you asked, which is about the compacts. I'm looking at the IGRA law, the Indian Gaming Regulation Act, and Section 2701, under findings, it says that Congress finds that, and if you drop down to number 5, it says Indian tribes have the exclusive right to regulate gaming activity on Indian lands if the gaming activity is not specifically prohibited by federal law and is conducted within a state which does not, as a matter of criminal law and public policy, prohibit such gaming activity. And, sir, when it comes to the charitable gaming and other issues that some people might believe are appropriate or necessary, I heard Representative Seifert today in a committee talk about once we become addicted to the money. That's essentially what's happened with those forms of gaming. This amendment would eliminate all forms of gaming, which in turn, if you look at IGRA, would eliminate tribal gaming as well.
And so just to follow up, Mr. Chair,
Representative Atkins.
It would then eliminate Canterbury Downs State Lottery and all forms of charitable gambling.
Mr. Chairman? Representative Atkins, I believe I've answered that twice. If you'd like it in a form that some folks around here don't give very often, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Emmer.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beard.
Just to be precise, it was Canterbury Downs in its original iteration. I think now it's actually Canterbury Park. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mayor call.
Representative Beard, is it a friendly amendment or an unfriendly amendment?
Well, in the sense, Mr. Chair, that it's offered by my friend, it certainly is an intriguing an amendment, and one I think would certainly be a serious and sustained public policy discussion. Representative Emmer, with the best of intentions, is putting his finger on a very sore spot for many of us who don't gamble and would just assume people don't. I used to work with a guy one time when I was between jobs when I used to be on the railroad, which is another story for another day.
DME?
No, actually, the Chicago Northwestern, but that's beside the point. The point is I was working at PDQ store, and our overnight guy, who was the nicest guy around, was lifting money from the till because he was running out and putting it in the slots. Great guy. Had a problem that none of us recognized. At another time, one of the neighbor ladies, not on my street, but a couple of neighborhoods over, held up the local, at the time it was the Q Petroleum store. Unfortunately, the kid behind the counter was one of her son's playmates and recognized her. Actually, it's quite fortunate because she was arrested and eventually got help. There are people that have real problems with this stuff. It's serious business. Nonetheless, in the culture in which we live today, people like to gamble. And somehow we have to accommodate that in a regulated fashion, which is why a free market guy like me, I guess, is okay coming to regulated industries and saying, we'll deal with it here so we can regulate it. Because for folks that have trouble with it, it is a serious, dangerous, and life-threatening thing. It disrupts families and destroys marriages. This is not good for the few of us that that's the way it runs. So I'm A-okay hearing the amendment, having the discussion. However, I think it could be a bill unto itself and probably tie up an entire special session if we wish. Fact of the matter is, right now, tonight, we regulate gaming. And this House File 3100 regulates gaming in one particular location in my district. And I'm asking that you respectfully vote no or vote your conscience on it. I hope it doesn't pass tonight, but someday in the future I may change my mind.
Mr. Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. My suggestion, I suspect that one or two folks might be impacted by this amendment. And I'm certain, out of fairness to those folks, that it's either been shared with the folks at Canterbury Park and Minnesota State Lottery and all of the charitable gambling organizations, or the intention certainly is to share it with those folks so that they have an opportunity to weigh in on it. We've got some here today that we, I suppose, could call down and visit with over the course of the next several hours and find out the impact of the amendment. Rather than do that at this point, I would move to lay the amendment on the table.
Representative Atkins has moved to lay the amendment on the table. That's not debatable. All those in favor of laying Representative Emmer's amendment on the table signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
No.
Division, Mr. Chair.
Division has been called. All those in favor signify by raising your hand. All those opposed? Motion doesn't prevail. Representative Atkins is 11 yeas and 13 nays.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would open it up to... it's not tabled right now,
Mr. Chair?
If there's people in the audience, we need... I'd open it up to some testimony. If they could pair up any discussion, that would be appreciated. And Representative Atkins, and we'll hear from them as well. I do think there's probably some people that have an interest in this amendment. Is there anybody in the audience that wants to testify for or against this amendment? Representative Walker, seeing none, we'll keep discussing it among our members or we'll take a vote on it. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an intriguing idea amendment, Representative Emmer, but I'm going to speak against the amendment. And you don't get to vote for your mom too often. Coming over here as a constituent of mine, I was sitting here thinking, having a conversation with Representative Rood, and my mother, who's 74, who has spent her life dedicated to the community and her children 7 days a week, and the only fix that she has is bingo. It is her one fix. And we encourage her every Sunday, whether it is snowing. My sister-in-law, who normally goes with her, she can't go. One of my brothers have to go with her. I don't go because it's my one day to watch sports. But it is, we all need a fix. And so on behalf of my mama, I respectfully will have to encourage members to vote no on this amendment.
Hey.
Mr. Chairman, that's just not fair.
Any other discussion, members?
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Representative Atkins.
I assume the Minnesota Lottery was notified of the amendment, so is Mr. Harris available?
I'm from Las Vegas.
Mr. Harris, are you here?
Mr. Feeney, Mr.
He's learning about gambling in Vegas, I guess.
They were notified of the amendment, weren't they?
I don't know if he knew it in Vegas or not. I don't know.
What,
Representative Emmers?
He's not the only person at the Minnesota State Lottery, I hope.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins, no, I didn't notify them. I'm sure they had notice of the gambling bills that have been up in this committee for notice for the past several days, and no, I didn't notify them.
Okay. Mr. Chair, we have, they're not that far down the hall. My suggestion would be that we send the page to go grab them. In the meantime, I'd like to chat with our friends at Canterbury Park to find out what sort of impact this might have on the horsemen. And Mr. Wilson was here earlier, and I'm sure that he would like to chat about the impact that it might have on local communities.
Is there anybody in the audience from the lottery here?
Mr. Chairman.
I see him crawling under the chair over there. Anybody from the lottery? You're the next contestant on The Price is Right. Well,
Dale McDonald from the Minnesota State Lottery.
Can you say that again?
Dale McDonald.
Neil?
Dale.
Make sure you have the microphone in front of you. From the Minnesota Lottery.
Correct.
Okay. Representative Atkins has some questions. Mr. McConnell. Representative Atkins.
Mr. McConnell, my question would be that I know that I've seen some data. Had I known the amendment was coming, I probably would have pulled it out, and I apologize for not being aware that the amendment was coming. But can you give us an idea of what sort of impact this amendment would have? How many people are employed by the lottery, for example, where the lottery proceeds go, and who benefits from the Minnesota State Lottery?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Atkins, there's approximately 150 employees at this Minnesota State Lottery statewide. The profits, last year we turned over about $106 million to the state. And that split up, I don't have the exact figures right here, but the split up between the general fund, the environmental trust fund, the natural resources fund, and the game and fish fund, and also about $3 million that was put in for the Department of Human Services for gambling, compulsive gambling treatment program.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. McCown.
Representative
Mr. Chair, I don't have any more questions. Thank you very much. I know we got you on the spot and you weren't aware that this was coming. The is there a fiscal note with the amendment?
Representative Emmer, fiscal note?
None that I've requested, Representative Atkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I had a question for the representatives from Canterbury Park.
Okay, is there somebody from Canterbury Park?
Mr. Chairman, I actually have a question for this witness before Representative Atkins goes on.
Go ahead, Representative Emmer.
Thank you. First, Dale, are you here?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, first, I want to make it clear this amendment that Representative Atkins is apparently a little surprised by was passed out yesterday during the hearing that we had yesterday.
No, it wasn't.
It was, actually. And I'm sorry, because we had it. I don't understand then why
that
others
surprised
didn't.
Me that you would have it, but it didn't get over to this side.
Well, it surprises me that other folks did have it. I don't know what the confusion was, and Representative Atkins, with all due respect to you and other members of the committee, my apologies. It was supposed to have been delivered to everyone yesterday. So for whatever reason why that didn't happen, some got it, some didn't, I'll take responsibility, and I'm sorry for that. Second, sir, some questions about the impact of the lottery that Representative Atkins didn't ask. Do you have any idea how many marriages have been lost because of folks' addiction to lottery gaming?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmers, no, we do not. The only figures we have from the Department of Human Services and the Compulsive Gambling Treatment Programs that a very, very, very small percent of the people that go into treatment are because of lottery. Most of the people in treatment are from the casinos or from pull tabs or from sports bookmaking.
Oh, I see. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Bremer.
Sir, next, do you have any numbers that can tell us how many bankruptcies that have been filed in the state of Minnesota are a direct result of a gambling addiction or gambling losses?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmers, I have never seen any figures that had any study that showed how many bankruptcies were due to compulsive gambling.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's all.
Okay. Mr. Chair? Paul Keith.
Representative Thiessen.
I would like to, this is going to be a discussion that really should take a full day, I would imagine. I would move to adjourn the meeting.
Move to adjourn, huh?
Well, you can debate all you want, but it's a serious discussion, but to deal with it seriously, we'll be here till midnight.
Well,
and I think we should schedule another hearing to do it.
Representative Thiessen has moved to adjourn the meeting. Our representative, we'll take a vote on it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion doesn't prevail. All those in favor, raise your right hand.
All those opposed, raise your right hand.
Being 9 nays and 13 noes, the motion does not prevail. Representative Allen. Anything further?
No, sir.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I asked to have a question asked to the folks at Canterbury Park.
Mr. Chair, I'd be there happy to answer on their behalf or call a witness from Canterbury, good. Whichever you wish. Please come forward. Ms. Sampson, please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Randy Sampson. I'm the president of Canterbury Park.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sampson, thank you for being here. I don't know if you were aware of this amendment coming or not, but can you give us an impression of what this might do at Canterbury? I assume you'd continue to be able to operate, right?
Representative Atkins, matter of fact, we were aware yesterday that this amendment was going to be proposed, and with all due respect to Representative Emmer and his position, certainly he has respect the concerns for compulsive gambling. That's a significant issue to Minnesota. It's something we take very seriously. I'll be brief in my answer and say that, yes, it would have a detrimental impact on horse racing in Minnesota and the several thousand jobs that are involved in horse racing in Minnesota and the other agricultural benefits that come from the horse racing industry, and I'll stop there unless there's further questions.
Any other questions?
For Mr. Sampson.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, I had a question for Mr. Wilson, if he might be available.
Mr. Wilson?
Good afternoon again, Mr. Chair. King Wilson, Executive Director of Allied Charities of Minnesota.
Representative Atkins.
You've heard the question. Any impact on charitable gambling that this might have?
This would have a dramatic impact on charitable gambling. Mr. Chair, committee members, charitable gambling in the state of Minnesota is about a $1.4 billion industry. There are 1,400 nonprofit tax-exempt organizations that conduct lawful gambling in locations throughout the state of Minnesota. Those 1,400 organizations have, on average, about 300 members. Charitable gambling employees, I think the last count for is about 22,000 to 25,000 employees. Many full-time, many are part-time. Being a pull-tab seller is a good part-time job. Charitable gambling in the state of Minnesota generates $60-some million in taxes to the state of Minnesota. That's too much, but that's what you get. It also has about $70-some million in lawful purpose contributions. That would be the various programs and projects that each of those 1,400 organizations support. I think one of the things that's really unique about charitable gambling, all the forms of gambling in the state do good things with their money. What's different about charitable gambling is we are in virtually every community in the state. And within a community, for example, if we're in the Princeton area, you know, we might have a Lions club, we might have a hockey club, might be a Legion, might be a BFW, Elks, or Moose. And when we're all said and done, we've really surrounded that. I came from the Columbia Heights Athletic Boosters, and over the years, you know, we have a local church. We have the Lions Club, and I can drive through Columbia Heights and we can go to the high school, and I can show you the lights on the football field that were paid for by lawful gambling. We can drive down to the city park, and we can see the park equipment that the Lions Club purchased. We can go over to City Hall and see the jaws of life that has saved several lives over the number of years, again, that the Columbia Heights Athletic Boosters bought. So an amendment like this to outlaw something that Minnesotans like. I think to take the $1.4 billion we do, the lottery figures are 400-some million. Not sure Canterbury. Tribal gaming is several billion dollars. Minnesotans like to gamble, and I think to do an amendment like this would just not be what Minnesotans are looking for.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Representative Westerberg?
Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to move to table the amendment.
Representative Westerberg moves to lay this amendment on the table. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. The motion amendment is tabled. Representative Beard.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Any more discussion on your bill? Otherwise, we need to take testimony. From anybody in the audience.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we testified the bill to death yesterday, but I'd be happy to call everyone back if you wish.
Do it if you don't care. No.
Excuse me, we testified the bill thoroughly yesterday.
Representative Beard,
Mr. Chair,
anybody in the audience?
Remarks, summation remarks here, if that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, I just have a very brief discussion.
Representative Atkins.
I don't want to speak after the author, so I know I want to give you the final word, Representative Beard. Folks, the only thing I want to point out is, make no mistake, this is a full-blown, unlimited casino. It's unconstitutional. It is a racino under another cover, and it offers nothing to the state. If you look at the verbiage, it is very artfully crafted. But it allows games against a sponsor or the house. It allows electronic images at an individual station. And it allows for card games to be played involving 52 cards. The bottom line, folks, is this is video poker at Canterbury Downs. It's also an unlimited expansion of the table games. But read the bill. In two paragraphs, it lays out the fact that it is video poker at Canterbury. There is no mistake that can be made. This is a casino. It is unconstitutional under current Minnesota law because the lottery is not having anything to do with it. And it goes far, far beyond beyond what was ever authorized when it was voted on years ago by the voters of the state of Minnesota. It's illegal, and moreover, it doesn't even offer a share to the state like last year's bill did. With that, I would urge a no vote.
Representative Beard, Mr. Buffalo is here, and he would like to speak briefly. Can I call him to the table before we make your final comments? Mm-hmm. Mr. Buffalo, welcome to the committee. If you want to give us your testimony, and we're short on time, so try to keep it to the point if you could. But welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Henry Buffalo, and I represent the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, which is located in northern Minnesota. And unfortunately, Mr. McCarthy, who was supposed to testify, is not here today. He had to go back up north. I do have a very brief statement, basically, for the committee, so it will not take a lot of time. But I will be available for any questions if you have them. This bill authorizes the play of bank games at the club. It authorizes the use of electronic images as a at a table with others or at an individual station, that is slot machines, and it removes the 50 table limitation that exists currently in law. This bill is basically no different than the expansion proposals for Canterbury that we have seen over the last several years. As such, the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association and its member tribes continue our consistent opposition to this expansion of gaming for a private for-profit gaming facility.
Thank you, Mr. Buffalo. Any questions? Any other comments? Representative Beard? Oh, Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Chair Wickstrom. Mr. Buffalo, is not casino gaming as we have it in Minnesota now for profit?
Mr. Ruffalo?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, no, it is not for profit, with one exception, and that's the Canterbury Park. The gaming that's done on Indian reservations is government gaming. It's gaming that's done by the tribal governments.
Representative Beard.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, since its modest inception in 1999 with a 50-table limit, the card club at Canterbury Park has done exactly what it was hoped, although artificially constrained by the 50-table limit. It has put a shot in the arm of horse racing in the agricultural industry in this state. This modest proposal to take the limits off the card club and allow poker to be played in response to the market demand that's there is something I think that will give even more of a shot in the arm to the agriculture industry in this state. And I'd ask you to vote yes on House Bill 3100. Thank you.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Beard, I had actually asked if I could make a remark before your closing remarks.
Oh.
Because I wanted to make it clear, while I have the utmost respect for my colleague, Representative Atkins, we had a discussion yesterday. The problem with having the hearing on two different days is people tend to forget what was testified to the earlier day. And the testimony yesterday was very clear for those that weren't here or forgot what was said. I believe Ms. Hikus was in here, and she testified that we have a very mature gambling market in the state of Minnesota. Very mature from the standpoint that we have these static gambling dollars that basically are being rotated amongst all the existing gaming operations. And if folks will recall the testimony directly from Ms. Hikus, who was here to represent the Mille Lacs Band, if I recall correctly, the reason that she was opposed to Representative Beard's modest proposal was because these static dollars, these limited dollars that are getting shifted among the existing entities, would actually be redistributed. We aren't expanding anything. We're just giving other folks the opportunity. And I guess, Representative Beard, despite the fact that I would prefer to see gambling outlawed, that we go back to a day that's apparently past us because we have become addicted to the money in several different ways. Again, I think it's commendable of you to come forward for someone in your district as opposed to a district that's 30 miles away that you represent that has talked to you, your constituent, and you come forward to try and level the playing field for everyone. If gambling is here to stay, which I think is unfortunate, then everybody should be treated the same. Everybody should have the same opportunity. So I'm reluctantly going to support your bill. Thank you.
Any response, Representative Green?
No, I don't need the last word, Mr. Chair.
All right.
But thank you.
Anybody else in the audience compelled to testify for or against the bill?
Mr. Chair, if I could say one.
Seeing none.
Okay. I was just struck by the aptness of Representative Beard's describing this as a modest proposal. I'm sure that Jonathan Swift would agree.
Duly noted. Seeing no more discussion, all those in favor, Beard renews his motion to pass House File 3100.
Thirty-one hundred,
as amended to the General Register. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion carries. With that, members, the meeting is adjourned, Representative Thiessen. And we won't be coming back tonight at 6:30.
Thank you. Rochester, everybody, Rochester.